The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
I take these words from our guest, who words could be used right now in our tribal society. I am not bound to win, but I am bound to be true. I am not bound to succeed, but I am bound to live by the light that I have. I must stand with anyone that stands right, and stand with him while he's right, and part with him when he goes wrong. I would also light the peace lamp, and please respond with the words on the screen. May peace be with us. Now, I'd like, our guest will be coming in a moment. You may wish to stand as he comes in.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Now, it is often at times like these that I am reminded of a certain politician back in Illinois who was constantly running for office. No sooner had he achieved one office than he'd wind himself up and start running for the next one. Consequently, he spent a lot of time traveling from town to town, making speeches and eating free food. Well, he found himself in a charming little town at one point, And he was in the middle of the dinner when it occurred to him that he did not remember the name of the town he was in. And he was about to make a speech. And he thought, well, it'll come to me. And he pushed the peas around on the plate, and he thought, couldn't come up with anything. Finally, he gave up and leaned over to his campaign manager and hissed, where in tarnation am I? And the campaign manager leaned back in his chair and puffed on his cigar and said, my job is to tell you who you are. You have to figure out where you are. Well, I don't have any trouble with that today. I know where I am, and I also know that I wouldn't be where I am today if Abraham Lincoln hadn't been murdered. Of course, you have to understand the circumstances at the time. There he was, standing in his field in the wilds of Kentucky, with his son by his side, monarch of all he surveyed, when a raiding party of Shawnee come out of the woods and shot him dead. That was my grandfather, Abraham Lincoln of Kentucky. Of course, he grew up in Virginia and had a nice house there and should have stayed in that house with his family and prospered. And, well, nobody ever would have heard of me. But he was told that there's much more opportunity in Kentucky. You can get land for pennies the acre and become a great landowner. And that's what he planned to do. You see, Mr. Shakespeare says that there's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough-hew them how we will. So whatever he had in mind, that was not to be. So there he was, dead flat out. And the raiding party scooped up the little boy, who was my father, Thomas, and headed for the woods. Uncle Mordecai was up on the porch and saw the whole thing. Reached behind the door, pulled out the musket, and fired a shot in their general direction. I don't think he hit anything, but they dropped the boy and kept going. That bullet that killed my grandfather, such a small thing, you could say sort of changed history. If he hadn't lost his pa, well, Thomas might have grown up and gone to a nice school and lived in an ever-expanding house, which was what they did in those days. They start with a little cabin and just make more onto it till it's a big mansion. That would have happened to him. He'd have had a fine wife and a fine family and a fine plantation of his own in Kentucky, and nobody ever would have heard of me. But that was not the way it was supposed to be, I guess. So my father grew up a wanderer on the face of the earth. See, the oldest boy inherits everything. Thomas was left with nothing. So he grew and learned the carpenter's trade and made some money and bought a couple of farmland, one to farm and another to rent out, and was doing all right. But there was a problem in Kentucky. The land had not been officially surveyed by the federal government, so nobody knew exactly who really owned what. And any sharp lawyer from the city could come with a paper and throw you off your land, claiming, well, you don't actually own this, it's not surveyed. And that happened to him twice. So he figured maybe it would be better if we were someplace else. Also, there was a problem with slavery, you see. My father, being a carpenter, would apply to work on some of these fine big plantations, building things, but over and over he'd hear, well, we don't need you. One of our people here has been trained in carpentry and works for free. We don't have to pay him. Well, that's pretty discouraging for a carpenter, or for anybody for that matter. So he thought, well, it's time we went someplace else. And he packed up everything and sold the farm that he had left, and off we went to Indiana in the middle of winter. And barely had time to put up a little shed to huddle in with a fire going in front of it all night long to keep anyone or anything from joining us in the middle of the night. But the weather improved and my father built us a cabin and we went on with our lives. We were poor, but so was everybody else. We raised our crops and once in a while I even got to go to school when there was a school to go to or somebody to teach it. Wasn't always, so I didn't get to go very long. If you added up all the days I actually spent in school, it wouldn't add up to 1 year's worth of education. And I've met young people today who've been in school for 8 years or 12 years or 16 years, and I thought, my, oh my, with 1 year's worth of school, and I got to be president of the United States. If you've had 12 or 16 years worth, you can probably get a really good job. Something with security that lasts more than 4 or 8 years, a job where they're not complaining about every single solitary thing you do in the newspapers. So yes, stay in school, I tell them. Get an education and then get a job in the school. Never leave, stay there. It's a wonderful occupation to teach other people. So I didn't get much of that. And then our mother died from the milk sickness, which we eventually found out was caused by the cows eating the poisonous white snake root plant. And we couldn't keep an eye on them all the time. They just kind of wandered all day long and came back at night to sleep. But if they ate that, it poisoned the milk, and you didn't know about it until you were dying. And that's what happened to my mother. Well, there we were, half orphans. We tried to get along for about a year, and then my father gave up and went back to Kentucky to court a young lady who he had known in his youth. Sarah Bush Johnston, her name was. She was, had been married to the sheriff, but the sheriff was dead. I don't know who shot the sheriff, if indeed he was even shot, but my father offered to pay her debts and adopt her family. She had 3 children of her own, and she packed up all her belongings in a wagon, and off she went to what my father described as their fine home in Indiana. You can imagine her surprise when they come around the bend and saw this tattered cabin with no windows to speak of, and not much of a door, no floors either. You see, our father was a carpenter. So he spent most of his time fixing other people's places, and we had to get along. But Sarah, she had real furniture, feather blankets, and hand-me-down clothes from her children that fit me just fine. And when she got done scrubbing myself and my sister in a tub on the porch, well, our lives changed just like that. She insisted we go to school. She also insisted my father finish the cabin. We want floors, we want a sleeping loft, windows, a proper door, all the good things. And there I grew up and learned to be a farmer and never learned to like it. When I was old enough, you had to be 21. Then legally, you could leave home and be your own person. Up to that time, everything you earned, one way or another, went to support the family. My father would frequently rent me out to other farms when he didn't need me at home. And I got the privilege of working all day long in the hot sun for nothing, which is a terrible way to go through life. And there I learned to appreciate the plight of people who were working all day long in the hot sun for nothing, and made up my mind that if I ever got a chance, I might do something about that. But first I had to make something of myself. I said goodbye to my family and went off looking for some place to be. Now, I had spent some time taking cargo down the Mississippi on a flat boat, and on the way out of Illinois, I passed a little town called New Salem. And I thought, now that's a charming, quiet little place, just starting out. I'm just starting out too. Maybe I'll throw my lot in with these folks and see how it goes. Now, I worked as a shopkeeper for a while, and boy, I was a surveyor briefly until the fellow who owned the debts of my little shop collected from me by foreclosing on my surveying equipment. So that took care of that job. But I was a useful fella, really. I could read and write, and a lot of the folks in New Salem couldn't. So I would do their writing for them, write letters, answer letters, write up little simple legal papers for them, and they appreciated my abilities. And they said one day, Lincoln, you're a useful fella. We need somebody like you in the state legislature. Why don't you run for office? I said, well, I don't know anything about that. He said, oh, there's nothing to it. You get up on a stump, you make a speech, you shake hands and kiss babies. Really, you just represent us and see if you can get some improvements down here. Get a proper road here, or have them dredge out the Sangamon Creek so the big riverboats can come up and take our cargo. So I thought, what have I got to lose? So I began making speeches. And just when I thought I was getting pretty good at it, the Black Hawk War broke out. Now, that was because Andy Jackson had sent Chief Black Hawk and his people across the Mississippi for their own safety. It was his theory, I believe. Somebody told him once that the indigenous population always fares poorly when the new neighbors start moving in. You can see it all through history. So he thought maybe they'd be better off someplace else, away from the immigrants who would cheat them and feed them whiskey and disease. But Chief Black Hawk didn't appreciate that. He wanted his ancestral hunting grounds and burial grounds, and so he collected his warriors and crossed the river again, and that means war. Now, there we are, us young fellers in New Salem. We didn't know one way or the other about the circumstances. We just knew there was some adventure to be had. So we all signed up in the militia. And at that point, I received the greatest compliment and honor I've ever gotten in my life, ever. My colleagues, my friends, my neighbors voted to make me captain. So there I was, marching at the head of the line with an old sword. And as I marched along, it occurred to me that I was the tallest fella in the line. And why, if the shooting started, guess who's going to get shot first? Well, that changed my attitude. When my first 3 months' enlistment was up, I re-enlisted as a private and marched in the back of the line. We never saw any fighting. It was all someplace else. We just marched and marched and marched till the war was over and we were in Wisconsin. And somebody stole my horse. So I had to walk back to New Salem and hope that I still had time to finish my campaign for office. But I didn't have time. I didn't have enough time to kiss all the babies and shake all the hands, and I lost that election. It was the only election I ever lost by vote of the people. I lost other offices, but never by the popular vote. I was always defeated in what they call the Electoral College on the state level. That's where if you don't have enough influence, they throw the election the other way. It's happened to me a couple of times. I don't think that's the right way to run things. And if they don't do something about that someday, there's going to be something awful happen. But there I was, not to be discouraged. I decided I should study the law, which would help. Got a few books on that and read them till the covers fell off. And when the next election come up, I stood for office again. And this time I was elected. And the next time, and the next time, and the next time for 4 terms, reading law all the way. Finally, went up to the Capitol in Vandalia and was interviewed by some judges and lawyers. And they said, well, Lincoln, you seem to know enough to get by. You can hang out your shingle and go to work. And so I did. So there I was, a lawyer. And I'd have been happy to be a lawyer and live in New Salem my whole life long. It was a wonderful place to be. And nobody ever would have heard of me. But the universe had other plans. So I realized somehow that if I was going to be a successful lawyer and an upstanding citizen and a good example, I should probably get me a wife and family. And the only problem there was I couldn't think of any young lady blockheaded enough to want to marry somebody like me. What did I have to offer anybody? Hardly any education, rough hewn, a plain spoken fella, a pretty plain fellow on top of all that. Who'd want to marry me? I'll just go on the way I am. And by that time, we'd moved the capital to Springfield, which was another up-and-coming town in Illinois. And the fellas one day said, Lincoln, you got to come along with us. They're having a Christmas party at the Edwards place, biggest place in town. There'll be free food. And young ladies, you can try your luck. I thought, well, I've got nothing to lose. And I went and come in the door. And there at the other side of the ballroom, the Edwards were so rich, they had a room just for dancing in. There was the prettiest young lady I'd ever seen in my life. She was so pretty, it hurt my feelings. But I thought, well, what have I got to lose? And I went up. And I knew who it was. See, it was Mary Todd. She'd come to visit her sister from Kentucky. The Todds were the grandest family in Kentucky. They were born on the right side of the tracks before there even were any tracks. And they were so grand, they spelled their name with 2 D's. God only uses one. So I went up and said, Miss Todd, I should like to dance with you in the worst way. And being a well-bred Southern lady, she couldn't turn me down. And we got up and off we went. Now, my style of dancing is peculiar to myself and the kangaroo. But I did the best I could, and when the music stopped, I put her back where I found her and went into the kitchen for the free food and to stand around telling jokes. Sitting next to her on the settee was Stephen Douglas, the Stephen Douglas. He was rich, he was well-placed, a senator, a judge, anything you wanted. I've known Steve Douglas ever since he was that tall, and he's still only that tall. But they don't call him the little giant for nothing. He turned to Mary and said, "Mary Todd, I know a secret about you." And she said, "What would that be?" He said, "I know that ever since you were a little girl back in Kentucky, you'd tell anybody who would listen that you were going to grow up and marry the President of the United States." She said, "Well, that's true enough, true enough." And he said, "Well, you should marry me. I'm going to be president, you know." And she said, "No, you're not. No, no, that tall, funny-looking fellow I was just dancing with, he's going to be President of the United States." Now, how did she know that? It occurred to me over the years, as I got to know her better, that she really did know everything. I might as well not waste my time trying to argue with her. So I thought, well, if that's to be my destiny, I might as well get on with it. So we arranged a date to be married. The date come closer and closer, and my feet got colder and colder. And just before the day, I sent her a letter saying I can't do this, and I run off and disgraced myself. I was feeling mighty bad for a long time. Finally, I realized I can't stay like this. I've either got to pull myself together or die. So I got out of bed and went back to work. And to stimulate my mind, I began writing funny letters about a fellow named Shields, a local lawyer and a fellow who was mighty full of himself and needed taken down. So I'd write these little humorous letters about him and publish them anonymously in the newspapers, which is an old tradition. And he didn't like it. And finally, he got sore enough that he published a letter saying, "Whoever's writing them letters, I challenge you to a duel if you don't stop." And so I stopped. But the letters didn't. Pardon me. History is a dusty business. The letters continued. And I thought, well, who's writing those letters with my anonymous on them? And finally, I asked around and found out who was writing the letters. Mary Todd, who was very well versed in politics and knew a thing or two. Well, I couldn't let her take the blame for that, so I owned up. I said, "Sorry, Mr. Shields, it's me. No hard feelings, you know." And he said, "Oh, there's hard feelings, all right. My challenge is still on." Now, being the challenged party, I got to choose weapons. I am no good with any kind of firearm, so I chose broadswords. Now, Shields wasn't any taller than Steve Douglas, and my arm's about 4 feet long, and the sword's about 4 feet long, and I figured he'd never get close enough to me. I could whittle him down in no time without getting harmed. Fortunately, our friends prevailed on our good senses, and we called off the duel and shook hands and went home, and then I went to see Mary Todd to explain the whole thing and apologize for what I'd done to her. And I told her that if she could see her way clear to still marrying me, I would spend the rest of my life trying to make her happy. So we set a date very soon. In fact, the wedding cake was still warm when we ate it. And we became a family in due time, as most families do. And I was a lawyer and a husband and a father, and I was content to be that way for the rest of my life, and nobody ever would have heard of me. But it weren't to be that way. Something was cooking, you see. They passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which intimated that the new states and territories might choose among themselves whether or not to admit slavery to their state. And I thought, that's not going to end well. There's an awful lot of land out there. It's very big. Where are they going to find all the new slaves to farm that country? There's never going to be enough of them from the South. The Constitution bans the importation of slaves. They can't breed enough down there to populate such a huge place. Where are they going to get them? Well, they might get them off the boats. Folks coming in from someplace else who don't speak English will come up with a paper and say, "You want a job for life? Sign here." See in Wyoming. Why, anybody could wind up a slave if you're caught jaywalking or shoplifting or something. You wind up in Nevada digging holes. That can't be. Anybody here could have wound up a slave. So we decided we have to do something. We started a whole new political party for that purpose, the Republican Party, after the Whig Party wigged out, I guess you could say. And I stood for vice president and wasn't nominated. And thought, well, that's all right. I'll go back to work again. Maybe I'm not called upon for high office. I'll just continue lawyering. And then my wife sort of encouraged me to run for the Senate. She She said, now the senator can get something done. The president, he does what they tell him to do. But a senator, no, they've got power. So I ran for the Senate against Stephen Douglas again. Now, he was still sore at me for stealing his gal, I suppose, and challenged me to a debate. We were going to debate in 8 or 9 different places and explain our positions, him of the Democratic Party, me of the Republican Party, him more or less pro-slavery and me absolutely against it. And these debates were very popular, you see. There weren't much else to do back then. None of those huge sports stadiums that accommodate all the people these days. If you wanted to stand with a bunch of people and yell about something, you either went to a Chautauqua or a revival meeting, or you went to a big political rally. And that's what people did. Thousands of people would come to hear us argue about what should be done or what shouldn't be done. And they printed all these debates word for word, as much as they could, in the newspapers. And pretty soon people began to realize that I was alive on this planet. I was invited to give a nice speech in New York at a church in Brooklyn belonging to Mr. Reverend Beecher. But there was so much interest, for reasons I'll never understand, that they had to move it to a much bigger venue, huge hall at the Cooper Union. And I worked up my speech and I gave it, and people were bowled over. Oh, these new thoughts from this big fellow from the West. We've never heard anything like it. Somebody called me the next St. Paul. I'm not sure what he meant by that. But it attracted enough attention that Matthew Brady wanted to take my picture. So he posed me just so, and he pulled my collar up to hide my neck and took a picture that didn't look anything like me. But it was a handsome looking fella in that picture, and they published it in the newspapers, and that made me what they call today a hot property. And they said, well, now that you've attained some notoriety, you should run for president. So the new party went up to Chicago and kind of bulldozed me through the convention. I didn't have to go. I stayed home and thought about what was coming next. But they managed to get me nominated. So there I was, running against Stephen Douglas again and two other fellas. My name wasn't even on the ballot south of the Mason-Dixon line, but those three fellas managed to split up the votes so that I got finally not only the majority, but I was approved by the Electoral College. And there we were. My wife had her girl's dream come true, and I was just about to be thrown into the volcano. Well, I got on a train and said goodbye. There are thousands upon thousands of books about that whole era that you can look into, but I'm trying to boil it down, the whole Civil War experience, you see, into some excerpts from things I had to deliver. So if you'll indulge me, I will read them. Politicians still read all their speeches, you know. The difference with me is I write mine. So it started with my farewell to my friends. My friends, no one not in my situation can appreciate my feeling of sadness at this parting. To this place and the kindness of this people, I owe everything. Here I have lived a quarter of a century and have passed from a young to an old man. Here my children have been born and one is buried. I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return, with a task before me greater than that which rested upon Washington. Without the assistance of that divine being, whoever attended him, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Trusting in him who can go with me and remain with you and be everywhere for good, let us confidently hope that all will be well. To his care, commending you, as I hope in your prayers you will commend me, I bid you an affectionate farewell. And I got on the train and went off in the general direction of the Federal City. Once I got there, of course, I had to give a speech to explain myself when I was inaugurated. And so there's a bit of that. Everybody knew something was up. No sooner was I elected than the states below the Mason-Dixon line began to secede from the Union illegally by the Constitution. They weren't supposed to do that, but they did it anyway. If you're going to leave, you're going to leave. So everybody figured sooner or later this push was going to come to shove and something bad was going to happen. So I tried to put a lid on the kettle. In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the momentous issue of civil war. The government will not assail you. You can have no conflict without being yourselves the aggressors. You have no oath registered in heaven to destroy the government, while I shall have the most solemn one to preserve, protect, and defend it. I am loath to close. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone, all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. And I hope that would cool things off and have people come to their senses and see reason, but it didn't, and they fired on Fort Sumter, and the war came. And nobody was really prepared for it. We had to do a lot of fancy dancing to get an army up, and it took us a while to train everybody and uniform everybody and feed everybody, but finally we did. And then we proceeded to go out there and lose one battle after another as fast as we could, because all the really talented generals had gone to West Point and were from the South, and that's where they went. And we weren't doing very well at all. And Mr. Horace Greeley, he complained in his newspaper that we were failing, that we should give it up and sue for peace and try to do things rationally without all that bloodshed. He said, so I wrote him back. I said, I would save the Union. I would save it the shortest way under the Constitution. The sooner the national authority can be restored, the nearer the Union will be the Union as it was. If there be those who would not save the Union, unless they could at the same time save slavery, I do not agree with them. If there be those who would not save the Union, unless they could at the same time destroy slavery, I do not agree with them. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union. And it is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery, I do because I would help to save the Union. I shall do no less whenever I shall believe what I am doing hurts the cause, and I shall do no more whenever I shall believe doing more will help the cause. I shall try to correct errors when shown to be errors, and I shall adopt new views so fast as they shall appear to be true views. Well, there I was, between what they call a rock and a hard place, damned if I do and damned if I don't. But something had to be done. I discussed the idea of promoting what we called an Emancipation Proclamation, but the cabinet said, well, you know, we're losing. And it's going to look like the last desperate shot on the way out of town if we try to do it now. If we can just wait till somehow we win a battle, then we might have the authority to proclaim such a thing. So I put the proclamation back in my desk drawer and waited for somebody to win something somewhere. Well, Lord be praised, finally, General McClellan had a pretty impressive victory at a place called Antietam. And that was all the stimulus I needed to produce the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed slaves only in those states currently in rebellion. Didn't free any slaves in Kentucky or Maryland or Delaware. No, we only had transparent authority to proclaim that we're freeing these slaves that we couldn't even get to. But it was an opening salvo, you see. We didn't want the European governments to support the southern states, buy their cotton and their goods to finance their war. They couldn't do that if this war was about slavery, for they had recently freed their own slaves, and they'd be hypocrites if they supported this new state. That's what the Emancipation Proclamation proclaimed. So with that as a stopgap, then we gave them 90 days to come to their senses and come back to the Union and all will be forgiven, but they didn't. So I signed the proclamation and sent it off, and well, there we were again. In the meantime, I have, the president is supposed to report to Congress every now and then about how things are going, and up to that time they weren't going very well. And I gave my report. Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We say we are for the Union. The world will not forget that we say this. We know how to save the Union. The world knows we do know how to save it. We, even we here, hold the power and bear the responsibility. In giving freedom to the slave, we assure freedom to the free. Honorable alike in what we give and what we preserve, we shall nobly preserve or meanly lose the last best hope of earth. Other means may succeed. This could not fail. The way is plain, peaceful, generous, just. A way which, if followed, the world will forever applaud and God must forever bless. But still, we are walking a fine line between defeat and victory. And finally, in July of 1863, we had two major victories on the same day. One out in Vicksburg on the Mississippi, where General Grant lay siege to that city until they capitulated, and one in a little town that nobody had ever heard of in Pennsylvania named Gettysburg. General Lee decided a last-ditch invasion into Pennsylvania would frighten the populace, and they'd sue for peace, and then he could go home. But it didn't work out. They had a terrible defeat and left a lot of poor dead young soldiers on the field. And it was decided that rather than try to sort them all out and ship them home again, they should have a cemetery there and bury them on the spot where they fell. Now, they recruited the finest speaker in the country, Mr. Edward Everett, to give the keynote address at the grand dedication. And just a couple of weeks before, somebody said, you know, we should have somebody from the government come and say a few things and cut the ribbon, so to speak. I'll write a letter to the president and see if he's interested. You're not doing much. So they sent me a letter offering me to come and say a few appropriate remarks. And I realized that this was a golden opportunity to try to explain to the people of the nation and the world precisely what we were trying to do and why we were going through so much suffering and death. So I applied myself, and on the day, I sat there quietly while Mr. Edward Everett explained the whole battle, and it took him about 2 hours to do it. And when he was finished, I got up and pulled my speech out of my pocket, and this is what I said. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Then I sat down. The photographer expected a longer speech than that. Before he got his camera set up, I was sitting down. He got a picture of the top of my head. After it was over, I didn't think it made much of an impression, but Mr. Everett sent me a note, and he said he would flatter himself if he was able to come as close to the essence of the day in 2 hours as I was able to do in 2 minutes. That was one of the finest compliments I ever got. Well, I went home, and we continued our efforts, and finally found a general who knew what he was doing, General Grant. Now, they complained when I offered his name as the commander that, oh, he's unreliable, he drinks too much. I said, well, find out what sort of whiskey he drinks, and I'll send a barrel to each of my other generals, and maybe we'll make some progress. And eventually, we did. General Lee ran out of supplies and men and support and finally had to give it up. He'd done the best he could. You see, but it was never going to be enough. So I was reelected. I thought that I would not be. General McClellan decided to run against me, and he was running on a platform of, we'll stop the war and end this killing, and mothers and fathers won't lose their sons anymore, and we'll have peace with honor, he said. And he lost. All the soldiers voted for me, and everybody else seemed to think I was doing enough of a good job to keep the job. And of course, I had to make another speech, so I did. I said in the end of it that if we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which in the providence of God must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war will swiftly pass away. But if God wills that it continue until all the gold piled up by 250 years of the bondsman's unrequited toil be sunk, and every drop of blood drawn by the lash shall be paid by one drawn with a sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right. Let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow, his orphan, to do all that shall achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Well, the only thing really left to do by them was to guarantee that the slaves we had freed with our Emancipation Proclamation would remain free. See, the proclamation was a delicate document, and I realized that it might be overturned in the courts after the war. We needed something more permanent. We needed an amendment to the Constitution, which we worked on and supported and lobbied for, and finally it was passed. The 13th Amendment guaranteed freedom to all people forever. And I thought, well, that's something I might be remembered for. And well, that in a couple of paragraphs sort of sums up that whole conflict. The rest is easily available in any library. Now, it's a terrible death to be talked to death, and it's usually the custom of programs of this nature to open the floor to questions, if any. If there's anything I missed or misspoke or something you're curious about, feel free to ask. If you're too shy to ask the first question, I can take the second question first. It is the hallmark of a great speaker to so baffle his audience that they can't think of anything they'd like explained. And well, let's see, perhaps I have a good story that's clean enough to tell in a place like this. Oh, yes, yes. One of the first, oh, sir, please.
One of your political strategies was to keep the French close to any soldiers in the town, people in the cabinet who had not been supporters of you.
Oh.
Right? Who was the most difficult person in the cabinet that you worked with?
I hate to tell tales out of school, but it was a problem. all the time my people were campaigning for me, I was back home trying to figure out who was going to fill these cabinet positions. I knew right away that I didn't know everything about government. And that's an old maxim that if you're going to give a job to somebody, give it to the person who really knows how to do that job and then let him do it. So I agonized and I chose this and that. And there were times when my people would come up and say, well, you've got to give treasury to this fella. He supported you a great deal. No, I told you not to make any promises for me. We wound up with the cabinet, one of which was a fellow named Simon Cameron from right here in Pennsylvania. And I knew all about him. He wasn't the most honest of people. Now, I'm not saying he's totally dishonest. I don't think he'd steal a red hot stove, but in other things, yes. He was Secretary of War and made a lot of money selling cheap goods to the army. Muskets that didn't work and shoes that fell apart, cardboard belts. He had to go, and finally we thought, we'll send him someplace where he can't do any harm and where he'll blend right in. So we made him ambassador to Russia. Then we found a fellow named Edward Stanton, who I knew from back in the Illinois Railroad lawyering days. And he was honest and strict and fair and was a fine Secretary of War. And so we let him do his job. Over in Treasury, there was a fellow named Salmon P. Chase. I don't know what his parents were thinking, name a kid Salmon, but there he was. Must have been an old family name. And he wanted more than anything else in the world to be president. He tried for the nomination back in Chicago, didn't get it, and never got over it. He and his beautiful daughter campaigned and conspired all the time to get his name in the forefront for the next election. Even to the point where when we decided we needed better money to keep the government afloat, he printed up what they began to call greenbacks, and put his own picture on them. And I said, well, you know, it's like the story of the feller plowing the field, and all of a sudden the horse takes off and is running as fast as he could, and he's plowing up a storm, and his brother come running over and said, look, he's got a big old chin fly biting him, that's why he's running like that. And I said, well, leave it there. He's finally getting some work done. And I said to my wife, now, if Salmon P. Chase has a presidential chin fly biting on him and it makes him do his job faster, we'll let him go at that. So he did. Finally, I had to put him someplace where he wouldn't give me any more trouble, so I elected him to the Supreme Court. And that's where you put somebody you never want to hear from again. Oh, yes.
When you were at Salem, didn't you write a book about religion where you quoted Thomas Paine?
Oh, yes, I did.
Skeptical of religion, so skeptical that your friend Berman.
That's a true story. They wanted to protect my reputation. I was very, very fond of the writings of Mr. Thomas Paine. I read them thoroughly. I also knew that if you say what you mean, sometimes you're going to make a lot of enemies, and he managed to do that in his career. But I was young and full of myself and thought, well, I want to show people what I feel. And my friend read it and said, this will get you run out of town. So he burned it. It made a lovely light, I must say, but sometimes you got to keep things under your hat, which is why we have such big hats. We got a lot of things to keep under them. Yes?
You said that the main goal was to, if you had to keep slavery, or if you had to basically just keep the country whole.
Yeah.
No matter if it was pro-slavery, anti-slavery, but personally,
well, of course, as time went by, I had various ideas. I hoped that the government would compensate all the slave owners and would give you the money for them to set them free. And in the Bible, the Israelites were freed and they left. They went out away from Egypt. And I thought, oh, we can colonize them, send them back to Africa where they were stolen from. Maybe they'd like that. Didn't like that idea at all. But it was incumbent upon me to save this country. It was only 67 years since Washington gave up his comfortable life on the farm to start this country, to get it free. And here we've managed to have it torn in half in only that time. We can't let that go. And I'm willing to do anything to stop the war, get the country back together, and then we can concentrate on the slavery business. We can look at it legally and financially. There's all kinds of ways to solve a problem. That's what I was trying to explain to Mr. Greeley and his newspaper readers, that we've got to win the war. He wanted me to free the slaves now by proclamation. But that's easier said than done, and I tried to explain that to him. The other problem I had, the first thing that cropped up when I finally got to Washington, was everybody wanted to work for the government, you see. And I spent a lot of my time giving out post offices and harbor inspectors and all sorts of things. I felt like a landlord who was so busy renting rooms out in the front of the hotel that he didn't have time to put out a fire that started in the back of the hotel. And I thought, now how did all this get started, this patronage system? And then somebody told me a story about a king in the Middle Ages who loved going hunting. And one day he figured it was a nice day for hunting, he was going to go, he called for his soothsayer, find out what the weather was going to be like. The soothsayer looked in his crystal ball and said, "Oh, fine weather, Your Majesty, have a good time." So off he went, got on his horse, and didn't get a mile from the palace before he come across an old farmer with an old mule. And the farmer said, "Your Majesty, don't go any further, there's going to be a terrible thunderstorm." The king looked around and said, "No, my very valuable soothsayer assured me the weather would be fine, so don't bother me." And he went on. He didn't get another mile before the clouds rolled in, opened up, and drenched him to his royal underwear. And he turned around and went back to the palace, and he sent his soldiers to find his soothsayer and his other soldiers to bring that farmer in to explain themselves. He said, "Now, how come my soothsayer doesn't know whether it's going to rain, and this simple farmer knew exactly what was going to happen?" And the farmer said, "Oh, no, Your Majesty, it's not me, not me. It's my mule. You see, when it's going to be fine weather, his ears, they stand up straight. But if it's going to be bad weather, well, they lay flat down on his head. And that's how I knew there was going to be a storm." Well, the king fired his soothsayer out a window and appointed the farmer and the mule as his new weather prognosticators. And that was a serious mistake, because ever since then, every jackass who comes along wants a government job. Well, I appreciate you coming out today, and I appreciate the invite, and thank you for the use of the hall. And well, I'd like to thank my parents for making this possible and my children for making it necessary. Thank you all very kindly.
I'll just extinguish our chalice. The words by Maureen Killer and Daring Vision. We extinguish this chalice flame, daring to call forward the vision of this free faith, that freedom, reason, and justice will one day prevail in this nation and across the earth.